Today is August 25th. It's our first class of God and Man. And we will be doing Parshas Mishpatim and Parshas Kedoshim, those two parshios, which are very much Ben Adam L'Chaveiro oriented. Every mitzvah of the Torah is Ben Adam L'Makom, right? Who told us not to kill? Who told us not to speak Lashon Hara? Who told us not to lie to each other? Every mitzvah is Ben Adam L'Makom. But some mitzvahs, in addition to being Ben Adam L'Makom, are also Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. They're also interpersonal, right? Whether or not I eat shellfish or kosher food has nothing to do with me and you, right? That's just between me and God. But when I cheat you, I am doing something against God, because that's going against the mitzvah of the Torah, and you, right? Which is why I'm Yom Kippur. For eating unkosher food, I can just go straight to God and ask forgiveness. But when it comes to cheating you, I can't go to God for forgiveness. I have to go to you and God for forgiveness. I can't go to God alone. I have to go to both. Okay? Fine. We all know. So, the ancients also have many law codes. We will be comparing, especially Parshas Mishpatim, to three particular ancient law codes. That's what you're going to find online on yu.edu. And we will be going pasuk by pasuk to show that every single mitzvah in Parshas Mishpatim, up to a certain point, has an exact parallel in ancient Near Eastern law. We will be referring to that law from here on in as cuneiform law. Cuneiform law, because the law, where we find these codes, are written in cuneiform. Right? If you remember that in 6th or 7th grade social studies, they wrote with usually diagrams. Okay. So that was their sort of their alphabet, way of expressing in writing. Okay? So perhaps the most popular one in your mindset is probably the Code of Hammurabi. Have you heard of that? Babylonian ancient code?
That dates back
before Avram. Right, so some of these law codes, all the ones we'll be discussing predate the Torah, the beginning of the Torah. We'll be concentrating on Babylonia, Egypt, and Sumeria. Okay, these are places around the Fertile Crescent, further down south. And we'll be comparing everything in Parshas Mishpatim, again to a point, to some of these ancient laws. Today we'll just do an introductory comment on some of these things. And I would like to divide the law of the Torah into two categories, and then I'll give you some fancy names, but if you're familiar with the names or not. One is called apodictic law, and one is called casuistic law. Okay, all of ancient law is casuistic, which we find in these three codes and whatever we've found until now. Let me explain the difference between these two right now. You will recognize, I'll give you some examples in Parshas Mishpatim, and everything in Mishpatim is casuistic from the very first pasuk in the Parsha. Everything in Parshas Mishpatim is casuistic until we'll recognize. Once you learn what this is, you'll be able to open up the Parsha and see where does the casuistic law stop. And I will paraphrase for you in English examples of casuistic law. If an animal falls into a pit, and the pit does damage to the animal, or if you light a fire and the fire spreads to another person's property, causes damage. If your ox gores, if it's the first time it gores, this is the law. If it's the third time it gores, that's the law. Right? A few other examples that you can... If a man lies with a single woman and he seduces her, she shall be his wife for the rest of his life. If she so desires, he can never divorce her. Now, these are all examples of casuistic law. Now, let me tell you apodictic law, and you'll see the clear difference. Ready? When you build a new house, put a fence around your roof so that nobody falls. Put fringes upon your four corners of your garments. Eat kosher food. How is this different than casuistic law? I'll give you other examples of casuistic law and tell me the difference, right? if you purchase a Hebrew slave, we'll find out later how you purchase a Hebrew slave, but he shall work for you for 6 years if he wants to stay on. Do you see what keeps on showing up in casuistic law, a particular short little English word? In Hebrew, it's in key. Casuistic law reacts to such situations, particular situations. You see it? There's no pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim that says, do not dig a pit in the public sphere because someone may fall inside and hurt himself. No, it doesn't say that. You're actually allowed to dig pits in the public sphere as long as you are careful about, you know, making sure no one falls in. Because if someone falls in, you're going to have to pay damages. You're allowed to light a fire in your property. There's no pasuk in the Torah that says, don't light a fire in your property because a wind may sweep it across to you and in the neighborhood. No, it says, if you light a fire in your property and it causes damage, you're going to have to pay that. Obviously, if it stands to reason, then don't do it. Be careful, you know. Right? Casuistic law is reacting to situations. Apodictic law wants to prescribe behavior. Why does the Torah differentiate between these? That's maybe a higher level than what we're able to do at first. But the Torah in this week's parsha talks about putting a fence around your roof. It didn't say if someone walks across your roof and slips, you'll have to pay him damages. No, it says make sure that doesn't happen. It's not even so clear that if someone falls off your roof, you know, what do you have to pay if he did have a makeh, if he didn't have a makeh, was he there, was he trespassing, was he traveling over from his house to your house? You know, roofs used to be so that people used to walk across them, you know, from place to place. So it just tells you in advance, make sure that your house is safe. Right? And from makeh we learn, make sure your tires are filled with the proper amount of air, make sure that your rear view mirror works properly, make sure that don't have an unsafe environment. Especially in the car, right? We learn that from makeh, which is, you get it? It is prescribing behavior. There is a prescription for behavior. That is known as apodictic law. There's no parallel in cuneiform law. Cuneiform law all reacts to situations. They don't try to prescribe behavior. It says, if you kill someone, get this, if you murder and stealing is so complicated in the Code of Hammurabi. If you want to know your punishment for stealing, you have to make a chart. I'm serious. Not that the chart exists in this law, but here. Can you see what's going on here? That the one being the highest level of society, nobility, two being, those who serve the nobility, three being free men, four being slaves, five being captives and foreigners, and who, it depends, if you're a five, and you steal from a two or a one, you're going to be killed. You know what I'm saying? If you're a one and you steal from a four, you may get slapped on the wrist for nothing at all. You get it? Halacha, the law treats you very differently depending on who you're violating and who is being violated. Now you see why the Torah has this pasuk so many times. What does it say? Talk to me. Paraphrase if you want in English. Talk to me. There shall be one law under the Torah. He even says for the ger, for the stranger, for the newcomer, for, right? My thesis of the beginning of this course, certainly today's introduction, is that the Torah is reacting to these codes. Nothing wrong with saying that. The Torah is well aware that the Torah wasn't given to Adam HaRishon, and that the law of the Torah is very much aware of what some other ancient cultures are doing, and we want to move away from that. We think it's wrong that you have to make a chart over what's your punishment if you stole, depending on who you are and who you stole from. Get it? Very important lesson we're learning here. Okay? We're going to see this manifesting itself again and again and again in the Torah setting up like a culture of
of law. Okay? Good? Okay. So we'll see that in Parshas Mishpatim, the Parsha begins with that, with casuistic law, holy, and then moves into evidence of law. Want to prescribe behavior. We say, Adrabah, we say, don't kill. There's no such law in the Code of Hammurabi. It just says, if you kill, now let's see who you killed, let's see who you are. Right? There's also profound examples of vicarious punishment. That is, that if I kill my neighbor's son, my son gets killed in the Code of Hammurabi. Torah says, Ish b'cheto you must. You have to wonder, why would the Torah tell me that? Everyone is punished for his own sin. Duh. You cheat on your taxes and I get punished? Who would ever think of such a thing? Right? Torah says, tell me, don't be so surprised that I have to tell you. Ish b'chato yumas, everyone gets punished for their own sin. Because in some other law codes, that's not the case. On the books, it's not the case. Alright, what about Hokeid Avon Avos Albanim? Translate that pasuk for me. Hokeid Avon Avos Albanim. I visit the iniquity of the parents upon the children. So if you said you don't do that. So the Gemara, in the beginning of the Sefer Brachos, which considers this to be some kind of a contradiction, gives a number of terutzim to this. But I would give a very simple terutz. Let's figure it out right now here in this class. Torah says, Ish v'cheto yumasu. Everybody is killed for his own sin, or everybody is punished for his own sin. And yet there's another pasuk that says, he visits the iniquity of the parents upon the children. Explain the difference. Who's the he in that pasuk?
Hashem.
Pokeda v'onavos. You're familiar, very familiar pasuk, right? You say it it's in many places in the Torah. It's in the Seretz Adibros, it's in Parshas V'sisa, right? So Hashem will visit the iniquity of parents upon children. That happens all the time. I don't know how Hashem rewards and punishes. That's none of my business. Right? Parents do bad things. They get into a car drunk with their kids in the car and they get into an accident. Those kids suffered for the sins of the parent. It happens all the time. Alright? What in my court, in a human court, I cannot punish one person for the sin of another. Not that? But I'm telling you that in the ancient law codes, that was a very common thing. Okay, got it? Just as a side note to this, I want to tell you another thing about ancient codes. Codes of anything we have found that have come to us archaeologically from the ancient world is that it can all be divided into three kinds of categories. If I find a large rock describing a particular event in the ancient world, it could be just an historical event, right? That I'm not even counting here. We're talking about what I would consider sacred ancient writings, right? Like we would put into Tanakh, as opposed to, let's say, Josephus telling us events that took place in the ancient world. There are lots of those. We found one of the most famous archaeological finds called the Mesha stone, about the size of the door, that describes the events of the beginning of Malachim Beis between the Moabites and the Bnei Israel. Right? It's not a sacred text. That's a text that describes what went on. Right? Clearly written by a very religious Moabite. He thinks everything that happened in the battle is because of his god Chemosh that he names in the rock. He names on the steel that he writes. That he caused all of his success to happen, and he's very thankful to it. What's interesting is that the story in Malachim Beis describes the same events, the same kings, the same places, only in Tanakh it says we won that battle. And then ancient rock, it says they won the battle. Right? Well, we get to write this history because there aren't any other Moabites who are reading any. Moabite has not left us anything. It's practically the only thing that we have in Moabite. They haven't left us a Bible or anything, or writings like our ancients have. Which one is one right and one wrong? They could both be from the things are subjective from that standpoint. But I'm not talking about histories. I'm talking about sacred texts. I'm going to divide them into three after this question. Yes?
Have you heard of the story of Noah and the flood? It's written by.
So, well, hold on to that and tell me which one of these three you think that Noah's flood story is for. Okay.
That's, that would be an example. Right? It's not just history.
I heard this from someone. You know what I'm talking about.
Right? Yes, of course. It's not only the Sumerian, Babylonian, the one you might be familiar with is the most famous, is Epic of Gilgamesh. Right? Might be the one you heard. But there are flood stories in other societies as well, besides Sumeria and Babylonia.
Is that like a direct parallel, or was it kind of different?
Could be. There was an ancient story of some kind of profound deluge that killed off everybody in sight. Now,
we're not mentioning the words exactly.
So even within Chazal, there are debates over whether this was in the whole world, only in Israel, everywhere but Israel. The debates at the end of the sentence of often, whether it's hot water, cold water, the debates about what it was. Was it a terrible earthquake right off the shore of the Mediterranean that caused a tsunami 5,000 feet high that enveloped the entire coast for 300 miles of the Middle East? What can I say? But someone in the Torah story was told to escape it. Right? What's fascinating, I'm about to give you three words on the board, and I want you to figure out which one your question fits in. But what's fascinating is that all those ancient stories of a flood that destroys everybody but a particular hero who built some kind of ark to, right? There's one thing different in the Torah than in all those stories, is that the Torah has a moral lesson to the story. What brought the flood was man is immoral. What saved the person who survives the flood is because he is moral. Simple. In the ancient codes, you know what brings about the flood? Either possible coincidence, or most often, because the gods are jealous of man and too much power. In those stories, there are a moral component to the flood, nor is there a heroic morality of the person who survives the flood. The person survives the flood in spite of the gods who bring it. The gods don't want to survive the flood. They want to get rid of all of mankind. Right? But now I want to write the three words on the board. Look, these are all Akkadian words. Oh, no, these are the English words. These are Akkadian words. Dinu, which sounds like a Hebrew word. Kapsu. And Shapru. This sounds like an Aramaic word. Shapir. Shapir means something of beauty. Alright, so Dinu Kapsu Shapru. Dinu, like Din. You find an ancient code that says what to do if someone steals. What to do if someone rapes a married woman. What to do if you light a fire and it spreads to someone else's property. Those are Din. Okay? Law codes, torts, partnerships. What do you find in Seder and Ezekiel? Especially Baba Kama, Baba Mitzia, Baba Basra.
One question about that is that you know if, I guess, if it says where Noah lived, like if you live in that region where the epic of Gilgamesh takes place, where it's not really...
Not a whole lot of place that people lived back then, you know. It's pretty much close by.
Right.
I'm sure you can Google anything about Mount Ararat and see all kinds of theories about someone who claims he found the ark sticking out of a side of a mountain. I don't think you need to do all those things. Like, look at the Ramban at the beginning of Parshas Noach and see how to approach this. Okay, so that's Dinu. Kavsu are rituals. Mostly, I would say the Kapsu Sefer of the Torah would be probably Vayikra more than any other. Lulav and Esrog, Tzitzis, Tefillin, right? Okay. Dinu or torts, that's like mostly Parshas Mishpatim, Parshas Kisetze, right? Kapsu are rituals. Holidays would probably be Kapsu, right? Shapru are stories. This is a good giveaway here now for you. Stories involving ancient man that have a sacred tinge to them. We're not just telling you a story of how we fought a battle.
But this
I mean, it's hard for me to differentiate in ancient sources between what's just history and what's considered sacred. Because in our Tanakh we have lots of narrative also. Just tell us the stories of the Shoftim, stories of the Malachim. We have stories, you know. But the difference is that our stories are told where every single word, you know, I only know this because that's how we've been studying. That's how it's been passed down to us at the time of the Talmud. Is that when it says that Avram was sitting in front of his tent in the middle of the day, it wasn't with a glass of lemonade, it was to try to invite company. So that we should learn to be hospitable. You get it? We're trying to prescribe behavior through all this. You get it? So am I sure that when a Sumerian was writing about an ancient hero, that he wasn't analyzing every single word of what he was saying in order to learn? I don't know that. I don't have any Sumerians still interpreting those texts that way. You know what I'm saying? No one is looking at any ancient stories of man from those sources and analyzing the way we analyze every single word. Why does it say like Yara, Yoruts, and everything Avram did for his three visitors, God did for us in the desert, and whatever Avram didn't do, God didn't do, and Mark Bogan see it. And you know, we have so much material that of course there's nothing on that for them. There's no one studying those things. Okay? So which one does Gilgamesh fall under? This last one, of course. So here's the point I'm trying to make. So far we have found between these three categorizations thousands upon thousands of examples. And artifacts of any one of them, right? Some a lot of print, some small amounts, few words, some more words, right? There are all books now you can find that tell you all about these ancient codes. But one thing has not been uncovered yet. Is any one document that has any two of these together? You get my point? If you have a code that tells, let's say, the code of Hammurabi. Hammurabi has no rituals in it. There's no kapsu in the code of Hammurabi. You understand what I'm saying? There are plenty of Canaanite, Egyptian, plenty of rituals. The Rambam is more in Avuchim, is filled with them. But I'm talking about primary sources of rituals from this time period. Mostly revolving, interestingly, around resolving the mystery of death. A lot of the rituals of ancient man resolved around about resolving or conquering the mystery of death. And we see a lot of mitzvahs in the Torah that react to that. Who am I to say why God told us not to drink blood? But I'm just telling you what the Rambam writes. I'm telling you what the Ramban writes. I'm telling you what the commentary said. You can agree, disagree, or come up with your own interpretation. Right? Rashbam even writes the mitzvah of not drinking milk and meat, right? Or maybe more the Rambam writes there also. The mitzvah of not drinking milk and meat has to do with ancient practices. Let me tell you something that's an amazing find recently in an ancient cave. I think it was found in Iraq or someplace there in Iraq or Syria. Found a cave. Chilling drawing on the inside of the cave that explains what we consider to be, it's one of the mitzvahs of the Torah, but one of the Sheva mitzvahs of Enoch. Right? It's a picture of looks like a tiger, some type of large animal, hanging from a rope, right? And it shows succeeding pictures of this animal with missing more and more limbs. Arm is cut off, and the shoulder is cut off, and they don't. Right? So it's very possible that ancient man, and it's only conjecture now. Now, I could have thought of this 500 years ago without knowing this. Why are we told Eilu Minachai? Why is that such a terrible thing? All the seven cardinal principles, all man is governed by. So what? I'll chop off a limb of this pig, and I'll drink the blood. So what? Why should we feel that Bnei Noach can't do that? To the point that Gemara says, that if I give a Ben Noach, if I give any non-Jew in the world a piece of Eber Menachai, I'm violating my Torah. Because it says that you're putting a stumbling block before the blind. right? I can give a goy on kosher food, right? I don't have to stop him from working on Shabbos, but I do have to try to stop him from eating Eber Menachai. It's one of what I think is one of his mitzvahs. And I'm responsible not, I know it says, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazeh, right? But I shouldn't be the one that's causing him to violate what God doesn't want him to do. All right, got it? So one, why is Eber Menachai so? So here's the conjecture. Again, a lot been written about this picture. The conjecture is that ancient men, when they caught such a big animal, recognized that the meat spoils pretty quickly, especially if it's the summertime, if it's the winter, you can pack it. They realized how long things last, how it gets you sick if you eat it too and it spoils, right? You following? So they realized that they tried to do everything in which way they could to make this meat last longer, right? So at some one point they recognized that, well, if we just lop off the limb of the animal slowly, it's still alive, the blood is still circulating, right? We'll tie up the animal, we'll tie up the wound, and right? And then cut off another piece. Keep cutting pieces. The animal can stay alive 3 or 4 weeks that way, instead of it spoiling. And slowly, they cut the animal until they cut off a part of the animal, that in which case it can't live anymore. But this and they would do it far away in a cave, and they can't hear the screams of the animal. Right? So this, if you could do this to an animal, you're going to do it to a person. Right? So it's possible. Anything I'm going to tell you in this course is only in the realm of the possible. Right? When the Rambam writes about a Nabataean or Sabian custom of cooking milk and meat together, and there's the two studies in the 20th century, one in 1927 in Ras Shamra, one a Harvard study in 1985 by a man named Zuckerman, who claimed that they found also archaeological artifacts describing this very ritual, and specifically with a goat, because a goat's proportion of weight of animal compared to the milk it gives is much more than a cow. Okay, a goat gives a lot more milk, but not more milk than a cow, because a cow is just so much bigger. But the proportion to the size of the animal, the milk a goat gives is much more than a cow. So the ancient ritual was to take the meat of the young one, the child of the goat, with the milk of its mother, and cook the meat in the milk. What for? What purpose? Because the milk represents the life of the mother. The meat is the death of the child, death of the kid, death of the young one. So by cooking the two together, we can dominate the forces of life and death, while drinking the blood of the sacrificed or the slaughtered kid, and communicate with the spirits on the other side of existence. They would do this with humans too. Right? So comes the Torah and says, listen, this is filled with the ancient world is filled with kapsu examples of bad stuff that they're doing. Don't get into any of that. I don't like the philosophy behind it. And I'm going to prohibit not you, not only to the philosophy, I'm going to prohibit you to the action that denotes the philosophy. Right? Here's the difference between, let's say, Orthodox Jews and conservative and Reform Jews today, is that the conservative Jew may say, listen, I agree with all the whole scholarship. It will really make sense to me. But since there's no ancient, there's no pagans that are doing this anymore, I'm going to eat a cheeseburger. When I eat a cheeseburger, I have nothing to do with life and death. I just like the taste. So the Orthodox Jew says, okay, right, there are no ancient pagans doing this anymore. So the Torah says that actions shape character. We have to keep to the action as well as the philosophy. The conservative Jew may also say, it's not proper for any human being to feel that we're the author of life and death. Only God is. I'm as spiritual as you are. Yeah, well, I want you to be as religious as I am. Torah says, don't eat this. You don't eat it regardless of what you think the philosophy is. Alright? And we'll see that coming up again and again and again. Alright? So that it's very possible, and I don't think I have to convince you any further, that the Torah actually reacts, in some cases, to specific pagan practices. Alright? So at this point, let me just review. There's no dinu that has kapsu, certainly no shakur in it. If you have an ancient story about a flood, there's no one learning din from that flood story. Are you crazy? That's not the point of this description. She's telling you an ancient story about an ancient hero, right? Like having your soaking out over there, Noah, right? And when you have rituals, there's no din involved, but our Torah can connect all three of these into one. Because to us, how Avraham treats his guests in Parshas Vayera is as much Torah and as much instructive of our behavior as the pasuk in Parshas Kedosha that has four mitzvahs in it. Okay. All right. Everyone clear? Okay. So, and I don't think I have to convince you on about this. Because the Torah generally reacts. That's pashut mode. And I'm going to hand you out this one page from Shmuel David Lutzato. He's very good at this kind of material. There's the general. Generally, the Torah is telling us all the time, don't follow the chukim of the nations in your midst. Right? They have all kinds of rituals and all kinds of practices. I don't want you following them. Right? The chiddush that I'm telling you now for the last 15-20 minutes is that in the Rambam, in the Morning Chukim, there are some specific examples of what's written in the Torah that addresses specific practices of the ancients. The cooking of the meat, how about wearing wool and linen? You might know five or six good explanations of why we shouldn't wear wool and linen. But it was also an ancient pagan practice. The wool is from the animal, the linen is from a plant, and they would show that they dominate the realms of the wool and the linen by wearing them woven together. The realms, you mean wool, the animal, flax, the plant. So Hashem says, stop with these ridiculous rituals. Right? There's even one commentary that goes so much further to say that the ancients would take this milk and meat soup that you make from this goat and its mother, right? And they would pour it over a special area of holy crops in a temple area. And then it's pouring it over the crops is a sure sign that the gods will shine upon our crops this year and give us a good harvest. So if that's indeed the case, then it's fascinating that when the Torah tells us not to eat milk and meat, remember how the pasuk starts? Tell me how we might be reacting to this. Listen carefully. Reishis bikurei ad masecha tavi beis Hashem elokecha lo sevashel divach alevima. Bring your first fruits to the house of God, give it to the Kohen, do not cook milk and meat. So everybody from the Karaites to the Rambam to all the commentaries are at odds. What is the connection between bringing Bikurim to the Beis HaMikdash and not cooking milk and meat again? Why are they mentioned in the same pasuk? Not once, but twice. Parshas Mishpatim and Parshas Kisisa. So now tell me the connection. Okay, come on, be proactive, think a little. No?
To appease the gods, I guess. So.
To have a good harvest. So what is the Torah telling us?
To bring your first harvest to God.
Right. Bring your Bikurim to me. Give it to the Kohen. That gift to the Kohen will be the morality that you indicate by with your sharing with them, by my holy representatives, will be an impetus for me to bless the crops. The crops will only be blessed if I make it so and I make it a good year for rain. Of course, the problem is that when people do listen to God and still it doesn't rain, then they start to think, God, you know, you don't keep your promises with us. What's going on here? Right? Okay, so God says, listen, I walk in the darkness, I walk in the mystery. You can't, no, just keep your morality about you. You know, things will even out. Sometimes it doesn't work so, doesn't work that way precisely. And that's an issue, you agree? All right? So let's read what Shaddal has to say here. Okay. In the beginning of Parshas Veschanan, the Torah says, listen to my chukim, and when the nations of the world hear of your amazing chukim, they will say, Rak am chacham v'navon ha'am hazeh. What a smart nation this is. Okay? By the way, are you familiar? This is an amazing pasuk because in Parshas Chukas, Rashi writes, Zos hukas ha-Torah, Adon ki amus ha-Torah, talks about the paraduma. And Rashi says, why is the paraduma called hukas ha-Torah? You remember? Why is the paraduma called chok?
It
doesn't make sense to human capacity. And the nations will... And then Rashi gives a few examples. He says, Shabbos, kashrus, why can't you eat pig? Why can't you eat shellfish? What's wrong with it? Right? You say because of trichinosis and because of diseases? No, that Torah is not a health code. Right? Torah is not a horticulturist code either. Let me tell you how to grow good crops. Be moral, that'll grow you good crops. So the Torah is, so make up your mind, Rashi. When the Goyim look at our chukim, do they say, oh, what a smart nation? Or do they make fun of us when they look at our chukim? Rashi seems to say that they are incredulous and they're poking fun at our chukim. And here in our pasuk in Zohar, it says, when they asher yishmaun, look at pasuk book, es kol chukim ha'ila v'amru rak al chacham v'nalon ha'am hazeh. The answer to that question is, it depends on your reputation. If you don't have a reputation for morality and wisdom, they will mock your rituals. But if you maintain a reputation of by the way, there are some places in Southeast Asia where the Jews are like gods now. You come in South Korea, everybody is studying Talmud. They teach Talmud in the school system. In China, everyone wants to visit Israel now in China. Right? They have a certain mystery about Jews. It's catching on in Japan a little also, but there's this certain mystique about the Jewish system. How do they succeed? How do they all... Right? Everybody I know, when every single classmate of mine finished college, what other group in America has such a thing? Most people in some areas of America, they did 30% finish high school. Everyone you know when is going to college. What's the success? If you make a particular reputation for yourself, they'll say that. But if you don't, warns Rashi and Parshas Chukas, they'll poke fun of your. They'll say this is nonsense. What kind of nonsense is this? Alright? Keep that in mind. Let's see what Shaddad says here. Mikan stiru ledivrei ha'omrim. Ki achukim asher chakak Moshe livnei Yisrael lukuchim hein mechukei ha'mitzrim v'shar ha'amim shebiyamav. Little background. You've heard of Ramchal? Moshe Chaim Lutzato? That's his great uncle. This is Shmuel David Lutzato. An Italian commentary in the middle of the 19th century. And there are about three or four others who share this description I'm about to tell you, but it's very rare indeed. Really only three or four in the entire century who had credentials to be accepted in the Torah world. And that Torah world means, you know, like the Netziv and the Meshech Chochma and, you know, the Rashi Yeshiva and the Volozhin, right? And yet, we're accepted in the scholarly world as well. Very few people can claim both. Chassam Sofer was not accepted in the scholarly world. He didn't care to be, of course, but you know what I'm saying? Chassam Sofer was the top of the learners in the Torah world. Right? The three names you can bandy around are David Zvi Hoffman, Avraham Berliner. Again, yet this is very, it's an elite group because even some people who were somewhat accepted in the scholarly world, you know, usually that got you kicked out of the Torah world, and vice versa. Right? But here are guys who were really steeped in both types of... So Shaddal, for instance, in his commentary, quotes really, really scores and scores of scholars and even Christians and ancient Christian commentaries and usually disagrees with them, but he's really out there and he's aware of everything that's been written on the Bible until this time. He was even aware of he talks about dinosaurs in Parshas Noach. He talks about archaeology. He was really aware. He used everything that man was knew in 1850. Right. So, but here he's saying that there are some people who point to similarities between Torah law and ancient codes, and they say that we just took these from those ancient codes. Right? Hello, top line on the next slide, left-hand column. If you want to follow me, please. If you're not following, if I'm going too fast, stop. It's important that you know what's in this box. Hello, b'nei doro shamoshe, hayo lahem l'das ha-dabar hazeh, yotzer mimenu, Anachnu Elipo. Then surely the generation of Moshe, or perhaps the generations before Moshe, who put out these law codes and knew these laws, Ech yeh Moshe tipesh kol kach, o az ponim kol kach, lomar v'yisroel ki hagoyim b'shamam esachdim ha'yel yimush Yisroel ha'chacham nabok. How could Moshe be so foolish or so chutzpahnik to say outright that when the goyim who made up these laws, right, when they hear that we have them also, they'll think we're so smart. You get his point? We'd have such chutzpah if we just copied the laws from the goyim. But wait, what I've been saying these last 40 minutes? I'm not saying that the Torah took these laws from the goyim. They paralleled the goyim. Some react to the goyim. Right? When you live steeped in a culture that every harvest season there's a public cooking of kids' meat in its mother's milk, and then you find a law code written by this guy who just saved his people from Egyptian slavery that tells them not to do it, right? Alright, so we need an explanation. Why are we reacting to this? What's wrong with it? Right? But all the Shaddal is saying is, and this was very popular in the 1850s, you see, let me tell you, what was becoming very, very strong in 1850 in Europe, in Germany, in Hungary, in Poland, less in Poland, in Romania, and it was pretty much the only game in town in America. Come on, what's the foot movement? Reform movement. It started to gain in its early forms, right? In the 1870s, America in Cincinnati opened up a reform seminary. They graduated their first reform class and only served at the banquet only on kosher food. No kosher food was available. Only shellfish. Only pork. And that created the conservative movement in America. They said, that's gone too far. So that was a totally American creation. The conservative movement was just trying to bridge the gaps between reform and Orthodox. So the reform movement is gaining steam. And in order to prove that the observance of these rituals are drawing us away from each other, you have to see if there's kosher food, you're drawing us away from the Gentiles. They believed in a Jewish messianic, or not messianic, but redemptive type of theme to redeem the world and fix the world, takin olam, right? And possibly even b'machu shekai, right? But they thought that the rituals, circumcision was out, barbaric, right? So the way to prove this is first to show that the Torah is nothing but copying the Egyptian law codes and others. Shaddai is saying, what stupidity. If there are some parallels between the law codes, which is what we'll see, make sure you get on that those sources online, is that because it's understandable that wherever you're going to live, you're going to have to deal with torts and damages and the like, right? Okay? And if we prohibit some things that they were doing, look, halo hayola hem lomar shehem am sochol v'garua, shetor sam genuva me'amim achir. They're not going to say we're smart. They're going to say we're thieves. We're stealing their law codes and choosing and picking what we want. Right? No. We're reacting to what your abominations. Right? Okay, that's his basic theme here. Okay, so hold on to this. Make sure you put it in like in your notebook or something, because we're going to refer to this quite often. Let me just ask you, I'll leave you with a question that we're going to start with on the next class. What chutzpah does David have right into Hillel, this pasuk that you said this morning in davening? Lo asochein l'chol goy u'mishpatim bal yidahum halalim. What are you talking about? No other nation has mishpatim. Lo asachim l'chol goy u'mishpatim bal yidahum hallelujah. So on one level, you can just give a quick answer and say, God didn't reveal the law to them. He only revealed the law to us. But to imply that the nations don't have mishpatim, it's patently wrong. It's patently false. It's just not mitzias true. So what does the pasuk mean? Okay. Does everybody acknowledge the question? You understand the question, right? Okay. We're going to start the next class with answering that question, all right? What do we mean that the Goyim have no laws? They have plenty of laws. Everything in Parshas Torah, I'm going to show you. I mean, I'm not going to show you the original stones that we found, but I'm going to show you the books that then include these Egyptian, Sumerian, like these. There were law codes on the books. We mean them well before Abraham, well before the Torah. Okay, right, we'll start with that.